Good evening. This is Milton Rosenberg. Welcome again to Extension 720.
Good evening. This is Milton Rosenberg. We welcome you again to Extension 720.
Good evening. This is Milton Rosenberg. Welcome again to Extension 720. Hello to all. This is Milton Rosenberg.
We'll talk about that tonight on Extension 720.
Good evening, everybody. Justin Kaufman here for Extension 720 with you till 10 o'clock tonight here on 720 and WGN Radio. The sun is gone and the night is out. Pete, we've been noticing this, haven't we? Last couple weeks, we've watched maybe we had a show or two in July and it was bright out until 8 o'clock. And then we get to August, early September, and you're like, oh, the sun is setting. What a great picture. Let me put this on Instagram. Now, it's dark. The only light is the neon lights here that we like to shine bright in the studio to keep us awake and focused. That is what we're doing tonight. You can always watch the program if you don't want to listen. You can go to WGNradio.com. We are always live streaming the program. Got lots to do tonight. I'm excited to be back with you. Keeping Chicago company. Riding shotgun high atop the mouth of the Chicago River here in the beautiful downtown area, the central business district, where there will be no legalized marijuana, as we found out from the mayor this week. Tonight, we got a wonderful program lined up for you, focusing on Chicago's rich and vibrant arts and culture. But it's less about the arts and culture, maybe more about the application of arts and culture, because let's face it, I could say that we focus on arts and culture every show. And in fact, there's so much to fit in from the Chicago area that we could dedicate every single Extension 720 from here to eternity on arts and culture. So what does that even mean? But no longer should we look at arts and culture as being ancillary. We can't afford to. As a matter of fact, you may have seen the news this week that the arts-based industries in this country, they're contributing to over $730 billion to our U.S. economy. To give you an idea, that's more than transportation or the agriculture industry. Yet we still treat arts training, arts education as secondary, a luxury, a novel pursuit. So tonight let's talk about art and how it impacts Chicago. But our segments and stories are more about the people using art in different ways. For instance, the new exhibit at the Bridgeport Art Center brings together 70 different artists and photographers and physicians to explore the question, what is healthcare? What if we could use images and other art disciplines to make health and healthcare the number one priority in this country, on this planet? No politics or policy, just people. Some people, everybody. It's the name of the exhibit. And the curator will be on with me tonight. Or how about the Floating Museum, a collection of artists in Chicago that have decided that the museum shouldn't be a building that communities travel to, but instead the museum should travel to the communities. That's the idea behind the Floating Museum, and this summer's installations and exhibits along the Green Line have sort of captured the west side of Chicago. The museum exhibit designed for passerbys. How about that? The commuter. You're on the train, and you look out at some of the green space in Garfield Park, other places, and it's an art exhibit. It's a museum installation happening from stop to stop. How cool is that? We'll get out of the studio tonight and explore one of the spaces right outside Garfield Park. How about that? Right by the conservatory. The Expo Chicago begins tonight over at Navy Pier. It's Chicago's answer to Art Basel in Miami Beach, the biggest art fair in the Midwest. But the organizers are not content on stopping there. They have their eyes on this annual expo to be on par with the likes of, like I said, Miami or Paris or Milan and the other art capitals of the world. So just how does Chicago stack up when it comes to contemporary art? We convene our first ever arts panel featuring curators from the Art Institute, DePaul University, and the Expo Chicago itself. So much. I'm so excited about that. How great is that going to be? If this goes well, this could be a recurring segment, right? Get the curators in town to come in and talk about art. I love it. And as I said with Ro and Anna, jazz guitar great George Freeman is in studio tonight performing. The 92-year-old legend has played alongside greats, jazz greats like Charlie Parker, John Coltrane, Jimmy McGriff. Just to name a few. Talk about an artist. Freeman has seen Chicago jazz up close and personal. Continues to not only produce music, but serve as an arts educator to several younger generations of musicians. Of course, George Freeman's great brother, Von Freeman, who passed away not too long ago, was also big on this. He had the New Apartment Lounge. Remember going, I was producing for Richard Steele, and we went down to do a piece on a Tuesday or Wednesday night, and Von Freeman, George Freeman, others would be on stage. This was probably in the late 90s. And they'd be on stage in this bar that was really, it's called the New Apartment Lounge. It really was just a A-frame house that was a bar. And in the back, they would just jam, and these kids would show up from the University of Chicago, or they'd show up from, you know, wherever. They were coming with their, you know, their trumpet case or their saxophone case, nervous, you know, sweat coming down the forehead. And they would get started, and Von Freeman would call these kids up on stage, and they would get a chance to jam with the legends. How cool is that, man?
It's when George Freeman was in his 70s.
That's right. Now at 92 years old, he's going to be playing at the Winters Jazz Club right here at North Pier. How about that? Which the club looks awesome, by the way. It's kind of, and I looked it up, the website. There's a lot of great jazz acts because there's not really too many places to see jazz music in Chicago anymore. Jazz Showcase, of course. What would be the other? Green Mill, of course, and classic. And then you got Winters here. So I think he's playing this weekend, the 20th. George Freeman, and he's got a new album out. We get so much to talk to him about and to hear some live. We'll hear some music from him coming up right after the break here. So lots to do tonight. That is a great lineup for Extension 720. Pete's here. Jordan's here doing the news, weather, traffic, sports, all that kind of stuff. We'll pay attention to what's happening on the field with the Cubs, of course. They got to win this big series. They got to win this one, 4-game series at Wrigley. So we'll find out about that. But much to do tonight in Extension 720, and you're always welcome to join 312-981-7200, whether by phone or by text. And we'll continue the conversation as we take a break and come back, and we'll get some live music with George Freeman. So stay with us. That's a treat. You don't have ESPN, perhaps? You want to watch the obnoxious broadcasters and the national broadcast talk about Mitch Trubisky? You can simulcast it on 9. I love it. That's the way it should be, right? 312-981-7200. It's Justin Kaufman. It's Extension 720. Got a big show lined up tonight, including jazz guitarist George Freeman. He's going to be playing at Winters Jazz Club right here at North Pier with Mike Alemana and his quartet coming up on Saturday, I believe, 20th. Yeah. What's today? Tomorrow? Tomorrow's the 19th, 20th? One of those days. It's this weekend. It's one of these weekends. But I'm excited to have George Freeman today in our performance studio. He has an album that he put out this year called George the Bomb, which also has special guest Billy Branch. George Freeman, 92-year-old jazz guitar player. He is in our performance studio with Mike Alemana and vocalist Joni Pilato. How great is that to have Joni here? And we are going to hear the song Homegrown Tomatoes here on Extension 720. Take it away.
So good. Homegrown tomatoes, they taste so good. Homegrown tomatoes, they taste so good. Homegrown tomatoes, they taste so good. Tomatoes. Yeah, George.
They taste so good.
Yeah, yeah.
Homegrown tomatoes taste so good.
Mm, yeah.
Homegrown tomatoes, they taste so good.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
Homegrown tomatoes.
Yes, they do. Yes, they do.
Homegrown tomatoes. They taste so good.
Mm-hmm.
Homegrown tomatoes.
Yeah. So good, George.
Homegrown.
Yeah, yeah. Homegrown tomatoes. They taste so good.
Homegrown tomatoes.
Homegrown. They taste so good, so good. Homegrown. They taste mighty, mighty good. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Homegrown tomatoes,
they taste so good. Homegrown tomato, tomato, tomato.
Homegrown.
Yes.
Yeah. Woo! There you go, George Freeman. In our performance studio with Mike Alamana as well on guitar and Joni Pilato with some of the vocals, Homegrown Tomatoes. We're going to hear from George Freeman coming up a little bit later in the program. Some more music from our performance studio mixed by Bob Ferguson. Great to have George Freeman, one of the great jazz guitar players Chicago's ever seen, in our performance studio tonight. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back. We'll continue our program, Extension 720, so stay with us. Thanks, Jordan. It's Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman, 312-981-7200. Coming up in the 8 o'clock hour, we're going to have some people from Expo Chicago over here, our first ever arts panel. And what I mean by that is that we have three curators, three very prominent curators, a curator for Expo Chicago, a curator for contemporary art at the Art Institute of Chicago, also a curator from the DePaul Art Museum, come together to talk about where Chicago's place is in contemporary art. Is Chicago a player? And also, hopefully they will be okay with my I would say, I don't want to say ignorant, but my curiosity for contemporary art and what happens, just a simple question. For curators, how do you choose what's going to be in a gallery? There's little things like that that I'm fascinated by, and so hopefully they will entertain my ignorance and answer those questions for him. We'll see if that happens. Coming up in the 8 o'clock hour tonight. That's fine. Well, our first segment tonight on this sort of special arts theme program takes a look at using the arts to push public policy, or in this case, public priority. The new art exhibit, Some People, Everybody, opens in October at the Bridgeport Art Center. It brings together artists, photographers, essayists, and physicians to tackle one central question. What is healthcare? The collection of artists have a mission to make healthcare and our overall well-being the number one priority in this country and around the world. Forget about politics. Let's focus on people. After all, we're living organisms, and all we are is one catastrophic event away from losing hold on our own health. Kimberly Sonnen is a curator and creative director for this ensemble and this exhibit, Some People, Everybody, which is at the Bridgeport Art Center starting in mid-October, and she's in studio with me now. Kimberly, thanks for being here.
Jason, so great to be here.
Good to see you.
Been okay. A long-time WGN listener. We used to have a flip clock on top of our refrigerator, and Wally Phillips and Roy Leonard, and my mom every once in a while would say, I'm going to call in. So at breakfast. So you've been a part of our life. So my grandpa Al actually went to the grave with a transistor radio on his ear listening to WGN, so it's just great to be with you tonight.
Well, thank you for being here. Let's talk about, where does this idea come from to do this exhibit?
You know, I think WGN listeners out there are loyal listeners, longtime listeners, and anyone who's civically engaged and grew up in Chicago especially knows that, you know, the truck driver on the Ike or Edens or Stevenson or Dan Ryan tonight, she's wondering about her health care. We got shift workers in the region thinking about their health insurance premiums and deductibles and costs. We've got parents right now, as we sit in the dark in the studio, we've got parents waiting for their kids to come out of drama class or math tutorials or swim practice or cross country, and they're thinking they're one injury, one disability, one illness away from bankruptcy.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's really what propelled this effort creatively.
It's a great topic to take on. Why do you take it on artistically? Because to hear that, and we hear it, we're in the midst of an election campaign, and we're going to hear different politicians talk about healthcare and different programs, and they're going to tell specific stories about people who may have had a catastrophic event, and everything that you just said will be echoed in some public policy forum. Why take this topic on creatively?
I think I would argue the last four or five administrations in the United States have dropped the ball. You know, we like to put it all on one administration or one president. But, you know, to me, right now, we're at a really exciting time. And I would call it convergence between the business community and citizenry. And what I'm seeing out there is very exciting. You know, here we have, well, let's take the nurses. Tomorrow morning, there's a four-state strike right here in Illinois, the University of Chicago. 6,000, 7,000 nurses are going to walk out for a day, and they're advocating for patients' rights. And we see GM as we sit tonight. GM is walking out a large part of their challenge, or what they're raising their voices on in the streets, is about healthcare and what they're paying for health insurance, but not necessarily getting healthcare.
Mm-hmm.
We've got here in Chicago, we're surrounded right here in this studio by teaching hospitals, nursing programs, medical centers where people from all over the world come for treatment. The Shirley Ryan Ability Lab, Northwestern Memorial, Cook County Hospital, Loyola Medical Center, University of Chicago, Swedish Covenant. We're in the middle of all that as we talk to each other. And I see this convergence now that's very exciting between the citizenry and medical students and physicians and business. That is to say, let's take 3 weeks ago, the chairman and CEO of Chase, J.P. Morgan Chase, came out, and 181 CEOs signed on, and they came out with a PR declaration, if you will, that they would change their game a little bit and start prioritizing stakeholders rather than shareholders. And then just this week, or last week, I believe, 150 CEOs, the largest companies in the nation, some of the best-known companies in the world, came out, and the CEOs signed on to endorsing common-sense gun laws. You know, this is all...
It's all happening.
It's all happening right now.
At various speeds.
Yeah, and I would say locally. I would say locally it's very exciting. Senator Dick Durbin last year started Chicago Heal. He called on the CEOs of all the Chicago hospitals to come up with a plan that would integrate the community with comprehensive health, primary care, preventive care, neonatal care. What is the plan for these CEOs? And he did it at a very interesting time, I might add, because Crain's Chicago Business had just reported in the spring that the CEOs of many of the top hospitals here in Chicago got a 37% pay hike in 2017, despite the increase. You know, it's disparity. It's about disparity.
Yeah, I think all of those things play out in what we see on your Instagram account, what we're going to see in the exhibit, which is coming up in mid-October. Right. getting the artists, when you get 70 plus artists and photographers and essayists and physicians together to curate, and you have to curate their work to come together, what are you asking from them? Are you asking for them to document health? What are some of the parameters that go into the work that will be in this exhibit?
That's a great question. You know, this group is extraordinary. They're international. The group is anchored by some of some really well-known and top-performing, high-performing photojournalists and artists in Chicago. The show is anchored by Chicago artists, Beth Rooney, Jean-Marc Gibault, Rebecca Torres, Adam Singer, Antonio Davis, a number of artists that you'll see presenting internationally, actually, on a regular basis. And so I came to them about a year and a half or 2 years ago, and we started this conversation via email, via late-night phone calls, several phone calls, coffees, meals, and we took our time kind of developing this concept. What did we want to say about health, public health, health care, health insurance in a very intimate, personal way? And whether they were a National Geographic photographer, whether they were the deputy director of photography at the Washington Post, whether they were a disabled artist living here in Chicago, they all really felt like they had something to say that might elevate the conversation away from punditry and statistics and algorithms.
It's strange because we live in a world where this issue, and you know, we talked about even in the intro, just talking about moving it away from public policy and moving it to public priority. But we live in this world, we're all human beings and we're all affected. I mean, our number one thing we deal with as human beings is the health of ourselves and our families. Yet it becomes, we let this issue become politicized. We let the left and the right kind of decide who is going to win and lose and what's best for this and that, how we're going to, all the things that go into it. And they take away the core of this, which the core is that there is some responsibility for us as citizenry, as you said, to put a priority on health and the health of our whole communities.
That's exactly right. And whether we're talking about international healthcare systems or the United States healthcare system, politicizing healthcare is uniquely American. And I would argue, or it's my opinion, I can't speak for every artist or every photographer or physician in our exhibition, but I would argue that improving public health and prioritizing, making healthcare accessible to everyone as a fiscal priority, strengthens the economy. And my friends give me a hard time. They assume that I think healthcare is a human right. I don't. I think it's a system that you have to build. I believe it's an ethical, social, cultural value to which you have to assign fiscal priority. But I don't believe it's a... I do believe not being harmed is a human right. And I do believe there are boardrooms and systems that do harm. But I don't believe it's a human right. I believe it's a system and a fiscal priority that you all have to kind of build consensus for and build and assign value to as a culture. And we're going that direction. We're going that direction.
Kimberly Sohn is my guest. She's a curator and creative director for an ensemble of 70-plus artists, international artists, that have come together for an exhibit called Some People, Everybody. And it's going to be at the Bridgeport Arts Center coming up here in mid-October. I think it starts October 18th.
Yes, it opens October 18th, and the press preview is the afternoon of the 16th.
And that's all coming up. And what we'll do here is we'll take a quick break. We'll come back, and we'll talk more about what some of the art is. As you know, obviously, we're on the radio. It's a little harder to talk about art. But I want to get into some of what some of your ensemble has chosen to represent when it comes to healthcare and health. Kimberly Sohn, my guest on Extension 720. Stay with us. Welcome back to Extension 720, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. We're continuing our conversation. Kimberly Sohn is in studio. She's a curator and creative director for an ensemble that has brought together 70-plus artists and essayists and photographers and physicians and medical students for a new exhibit called Some People, Everybody. It's really taking on the question of what is healthcare. It's going to be at the Bridgeport Arts Center coming up in mid-October, October 18th. But it can be found on Instagram. This is the fun part about this, that's how we started to talk, because it was an Instagram account.
Yes.
That you put in all the work, you continue to lay it out before we even get to the exhibits. So you can find that at Some People Everybody, which is the account, and also somepeopleeverybody.com.
That's right.
All right, Kimberly. The question, and we'll kind of go back to it, but this idea that this is the best way to take on this topic. This topic is one that obviously gets played in policy discussions, but also in politics. And it also is played by authors, and people do huge dissertations on this and thesis about what to do about healthcare in this country and public health and our overall well-being. Why use art?
I think collectively as a group, this group is an extraordinary, exceptional group of high-performing artists. Some of us travel 8 months a year with National Geographic. Some of us work from our homes in studios as disabled persons, disabled artists. Some of us get commissions and assignments and do commercial work and cobble our careers together in a number of ways, working with journalistic entities but also commercial entities. One thing we have in common, one thing that we've experienced, and there's a 19-year-old in this show, and we have a 90-year-old in this show. We have a student photographer all the way to a senior National Geographic photographer. So the range of experience and the range of...
And experience with health and
exactly,
and healthcare,
and,
of course.
And what we've documented as witnesses and journalists and producers and editors, but also physicians and medical students, what we've witnessed. We thought it would be best to pull away from statistics, pull away from the trillion-dollar, billion-dollar conversations that go around healthcare. I think people are saturated. I don't think they can take many... I don't think they can take the numbers anymore.
Right.
It's just out of reach.
The numbers are weaponized.
The number, and it's just out of reach. People are just looking to run payroll tonight. Someone's running payroll for their small business in Willowbrook, in Inglewood, you know, in Whiting. And they're trying to figure out how to make payroll and pay for health insurance for their employees. So what we're doing is we're stepping back and we're trying to reach people emotionally. And we're trying to elevate the conversation back to the body, the universal body. You know, we're all made of water. We all are made of pumps and valves and levers and cartilage. And some people in the exhibition and who will witness the exhibition believe the body is a vessel, a spiritual vessel. And some people believe it's a machine, an athletic machine. Some people abuse their body. Some people take care of their body. But everyone has a different perspective on it. But it's something we all have in common. And so we've got images of birth, we've got images of end of life, we've got a great image of Venus Williams and playing at Wimbledon, we've got the body in decay, we've got the body trail running, we've got what it is to be a parent, what it is to be a mother, a father, a disabled person, a blind person, deaf person, and it really runs the gamut. So a lot of these images are celebrating the body, celebrating what it is to see the body at its fullest potential, and that means something different for everyone. But the one thing we have in common is we all have a need for healthcare maintenance from pre-birth to end of life.
Yeah.
That's the one thing we have in common.
It was a great way that you just explained what some of the things we may see in the exhibit are, and as we're on radio, of course, but you know, we can describe.
Yeah, we can give it a shot.
Give us an idea of what we will see when we come into the exhibit. Is it just straight up photography and sort of documentation, almost like the a documentary style,
like,
or is it
black
or
and white.
Abstract? What are we doing?
Right. Black and white print on white wall.
Right.
Black and white print on white wall. Black and white print. We are going the opposite direction.
Good.
Yeah, and this group collectively agreed that we would make it a very 2D, 3D, multi-format, multidisciplinary show. So you're going to see illustration from Rebecca Torres. You're going to see a painting by Nicholas Smith out in Los Angeles. You're going to see a large-scale, beautiful photograph from Kat Gwynn on what she experienced getting treatment during cancer. You're going to see expansive images from National Geographic photographer and Seven Photo member Ed Cashy of the Senior Olympics, you know, people reaching their athletic potential at the age of
That's
75
great.
And 80.
Yeah.
Ruben Salgado has a multimedia piece. We've got birth, what it is to witness birth and celebrate birth. so many different images. Jean-Marc Gibou has images about the vaccine, the anti-vaccine movement. We've got Lloyd DeGrain, the exceptional photographer from Chicago, who's been documenting right here in Chicago, right here, a few stories down from where we sit, the abuse, the opioid abuse epidemic that's happening as we speak. Right. So he's been documenting that for years. We also have a photographer who is a type 1 diabetic. And for the first time, after 6 months of conversation, he agreed to come in and share that experience and what it's done to his career and his life.
The show is called Some People, Everybody, and it's going to be at the Bridgeport Arts Center coming up on October 18th, a great space right there on 35th and Ashland, or just
35th and Racine.
Racine.
That's right.
The also, you can find it at Some People, Everybody on Instagram and also somepeopleeverybody.com. Kimberly Sonnen is the curator and the creative director for this amazing ensemble that's been put together to really ask the question, what is healthcare? Kimberly, thanks for coming in studio and talking about the exhibit, and good luck with it coming up in October.
Thank you so much, Justin.
Welcome back to Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, it's that time of year again as the art world converges on Navy Pier for the International Exposition of Contemporary and Modern Art, Expo Chicago. This is the annual event that brings curators, collectors, gallery owners, and art lovers together to showcase work, host panels, and have conversations about the strength of the contemporary art world. Expo Chicago continues to be Chicago's answer to Art Basel in Miami Beach. Tonight, we've invited three prominent curators in Chicago's contemporary art scene to talk about art and Chicago's place in the art world. First, the Expo Chicago Artistic Director and also the Editor-in-Chief of the Scene, Stephanie Cristello. Stephanie, thanks for being here.
Thanks so much for having us on.
From the Art Institute of Chicago, contemporary art curator Hendrik Folkerts. Hendrik, thanks for being here.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
And the Director and Chief Curator for the DePaul Art Museum, Julie Rodriguez-Widholm. Julie, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you all for being here for Extension 720. Talk about one of my favorite topics, contemporary art. Expo Chicago. What's different about this year, or Stephanie, do you try to curate year to year, like that you try to build on what you did last year?
I would say it's a mix. You know, one of the benefits of having an international art fair every year is that you can have flexibility and agility and curating and organizing programs that are very specific to that year that feel relevant and current. But perhaps unlike other art fairs, we also work on 2 to 3 years out for more major installations, exhibitions, and alignments.
Really?
Yeah. So, you know, I sort of cut off some of the curatorial projects that we're working on about right now, being, you know, the week of the fair, and start working towards 2020 and 2021. But, you know, even a few days ago, there were a few programs that came by my desk that seemed like the perfect thing to do this year because they were relevant and timely. So we have the ability to sort of turn those things on.
Is that the idea? I, as a curator, are you thinking about what's relevant, what's right now, what's going to be the theme of Expo Chicago?
There's a mix also. You know, thematically, there's no one overarching theme to Expo. The beauty of it is in the diversity and the breadth of the programming. So, you know, for us in particular, there are a few themes that we really wanted to work on this year, and that happens within our programming. Specifically the Dialogues program, we're doing a symposium on Utopia that draws together artists from all over the world, as well as curators and scholars, to talk about utopian concepts and ultimately the failures of utopia. If a utopia ever existed, it wouldn't be a utopia anymore. So we have,
you sounds know. Like every Chicago neighborhood, right? Utopia, now it's gentrified,
right? So we have these artists that were working in the post-Soviet Union, the Kabakovs, who were part of the Moscow conceptualists, and will be doing a major site-specific project at Navy Pier and also speaking about how they've addressed utopia in their work since the 1960s. And a Hong Kong artist named Samson Young, who is also doing a performance with us with the Chicago Symphony Orchestra, reenacting all of the 1933 World's Fair music scores.
Oh, that's great.
So it's the music for the World's Fair, a century of progress.
Okay, can I ask my first? I feel like I get three dumb questions for this as I try to catch
you
up to the contemporary.
As many as I want.
As a curator, and that, this is for all of you, but when listening to Stephanie talk about putting together the programming and talking about Moscow conceptualists from the 60s, Are these just things that you've accumulated and the experience, you know all the different art history and what goes through it? Or is it continually like a learning process for you guys to know all about the different artistic projects that are happening around the world or throughout history and time?
I would say this is an excellent question, and it's actually both. I mean, I'm an art historian, so I have, like, you know, a framework, of course. I know about art history. I know more or less what happened when and with whom, but I also learn every day, and this sounds a bit, you know, well, but it's really true. I learn about young artists coming into the scene, making, like, new work that is about our own time, and sometimes even, and those are the most sort of, you know, for an art historian, the most, like, wonderful sort of times that you kind of like rediscover certain historical artists who may have been overlooked for like various reasons. And that's why I think sort of the art fair in Chicago is so important here, because you get to do both. You get to see kind of, you know, really historically like significant works such as, yeah, the sort of Moscow conceptualist, but also an artist like Samson Young, who's from Hong Kong, who's been doing like amazing work there. I got to know him a little bit like a couple of years ago, and now he's here in Chicago, which is amazing.
That's great.
I agree. I always tell people that one of the best things about my job and why I've stayed in the field for so long is because I am always discovering and learning. We are able and fortunate to be able to learn from the artists that we work with and kind of in some ways enter their world and their perspective on the world through their work and through the process of curating an exhibition with them. You know, I think the art fair has really become much more than just a place with booths from various galleries to see art. Really, it's a sort of become an intellectual hub for conversation and dialogue and creating connections between different areas of the world, perhaps. It's kind of a place of convening. So, yes, on one hand, it's a place where you can go buy art, but increasingly, it's so much more, and it's become ambitious in its programming and a place for convening. I think that's really an important thing to think about. How do we come together as a city, as collaborators, as colleagues?
And we're constantly learning from each other.
You know, when you have an international art fair like this, and you are playing to an audience that's coming in from around the world, whether it be galleries, curators, and artists themselves, how much do you want to put Chicago front and center? How much does you want to showcase what's happening here to the hundreds of thousands of people that are going to come in?
Well, ever since I've been here, which is not too long, of course, but like mid-September is marked. You know, we know that sort of expo is, you know, going to happen, and the Art Institute definitely sort of tries to set its best foot forward. And I see that this with many other institutions in the city, that, you know, it's a time when you know that a large sort of, let's say, a concentration of like people and artists are coming to the city, so you want to, you know, give it all you got. And so when you go to the Art Institute, you'll see new sort of, let's say, exhibitions, collection displays, special commissions. And yeah, because we want the world to see what we do, you know, and that's ultimately what it's all about, getting people through the door and sort of sharing this wider conversation about art. Mm-hmm. And I think, yeah, September is a great moment for
this,
that reason.
Stephanie, put your hat on, the other hat from the scene, as opposed to your curator hat, but Chicago has gone leaps and bounds in terms of the contemporary art scene in the last couple of years, where it, because of Expo and because of other artists that are from here, it seems more and more that Chicago is trying to, you know, have a footprint when it comes to at least the American contemporary art scene.
Absolutely. And, you know, even from the very beginning, because all of the work that we do with the scene and the publishing and the commitment to criticism and rigorous programming is a shared sentiment, not just between Expo Chicago and the scene, but also both of these institutions, the Art Institute of Chicago, the DePaul Art Museum, and all of our other civic partners. I would say what makes the difference is, you know, from the very beginning, Expo, when it relaunched, I've been with the fair now for 7 years. It's going into its 8th edition, was not going to be a regional art fair. We wanted to be a major international art fair. But the way that you do that, or the way that, you know, we've approached it, is to have major international artists, but also looking to our own Chicago landscape and highlighting all of the amazing things that we have going on here. So whether that's artist studio visits, all of the institutions in Chicago, really supporting each other and not making it a Chicago versus the world conversation, but really Chicago is already a major part of the international art world, and it's our job to just highlight that.
I think of Chicago, and I would think that if you just looked at art like music or theater and other cultural pursuits, you would see that some of the same things that are happening to those could be happening to the art world, meaning to have a studio in Chicago can be pretty expensive. To be an artist and be able to keep a gallery in one area, whether it be River North or West Loop, it all depends on how the fluctuation of the real estate is there. I wonder how much that has an effect on whether or not Chicago is a true art scene when it has to ebb and flow based on the way that the economics of the city work.
I think compared to cities around the United States, Chicago's actually quite affordable. And I think we have a very deep, rich Chicago arts community within Chicago because of that. And there are always artists who will come to school here. We have an amazing group of educational institutions, higher education, that offer MFA programs. And so there's a very strong emerging artist scene here. Some of them go to LA, New York, and elsewhere, Berlin. But I increasingly am hearing that Chicago is very attractive because it's more affordable and because there are so many amazing mid-career and established artists here. It's a place where you can thrive as an artist, unlike some other more expensive, bigger cities.
I think, yes, absolutely. I mean, Chicago, of the, let's say, three large American cities, is the most affordable and in development, you know, like it's, you really feel an energy in the city. At least I've been feeling that, like that things are on the move here, you know. And I think artists always like to be a part of that. So I think there's one reason for artists to stay here after school or if they move here. But also, and this, I think really Expo has something to, you know, do with that. Like the sort of commercial scene has been thriving as well. I would say like 10 years ago, many sort of Chicago-based collectors would say, okay, I buy my art in the fair in Los Angeles or in like New York, or, you know, I go there to buy art. But that has shifted. And from the Art Institute, of course, I meet a lot of collectors, and I really encourage them buy in Chicago because A, it is better for the city, and B, you're getting a better bargain unless you want to pay like three times as much in 5 years in like some New York gallery, you know?
Right?
Like, so I think there's really a reason to do things in Chicago at the moment.
And it's been amazing to just watch the Chicago artists that didn't particularly have commercial support in previous years now have their first studio visit with a major European gallery and get representation out of that, or their first museum exhibition outside of the United States. All of this happened in the last 3 to 4 years, where that type of exchange and connection was not available to the artists. So, you know, as much as Expo is a commercial platform, and of course, commerce has to take place with all of our galleries, otherwise we don't have a fair, my mission has really been to push the institutional and curatorial collaborations between artists and the institutions in Chicago.
Expo Chicago is happening throughout the weekend. Expo Chicago's artistic director, Stephanie Cristello, is here from the Art Institute of Chicago. Contemporary art curator Hendrik Folkerts is here as well. And the director and chief curator for DePaul Art Museum, Julie Rodriguez-Widholm, is here as well. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back more on Extension 720. Stay with us. Welcome back to Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. We're talking about Expo Chicago and contemporary art in Chicago. In studio tonight, the Expo Chicago Artistic Director, Stephanie Cristello. She's also the Editor-in-Chief of The Scene. From the Art Institute of Chicago, contemporary art curator Hendrik Folkerts and Director and Chief Curator for the DePaul Art Museum, Julie Rodriguez-Widholm. All right, it's so interesting when you guys throw around words like commercial. In other words, that I think that the layman like myself, who doesn't, I have a huge curiosity for contemporary art. I don't know all the terms, but I do know that in the last couple of years, I've been seeing more and more, whether it be documentaries, whether it be other, you know, pieces of media and stories being told about how the contemporary art world works. And it does seem to be that, you know, there's one conversation to have about the artist. There's also another conversation to have about the collector. There's also a conversation to have about museums and universities. Mm-hmm. It all kind of comes together. So do you find, Stephanie, when you're programming Expo Chicago, that you have to have specific panels or conversations for each one of those groups?
Yes, absolutely. So we have various types of programming. I like to do it a little bit differently, where the panel, you know, let's say I'm organizing a conversation, the panel would be as interesting to someone that knows about the artist and has a full knowledge, because it's going to be coming at it from a different angle that maybe hadn't been given attention before. And it's also going to be academically digestible for and approachable for any, you know, person that is interested in contemporary culture to also view the discussion and join to be a part of it. I think that that's incredibly important. You know, the art world is sort of purposefully opaque in a lot of ways. And our role being a fair is to really open that up and not dumb down the conversation in any way, but really make it accessible and show people what how contemporary art relates to our everyday world and that it doesn't exist in a vacuum.
So many times the contemporary artists among us will be the ones that create pieces that are going to be more reflective of where we're living or how
Absolutely.
We're living. I think about the Art Institute as a good example where you have very unique and specific, and I would say you have to be somewhat of a connoisseur of a certain contemporary art if you're going to go into one exhibit. You don't know the artist, but you love the art. You also have Warhol or what might be coming where the bigger names that are more mainstream are going to maybe get people to take the Metro train down to Chicago. So how do you balance both Julie and Hendrik? How do you balance that name that people are going to know to bring people into the gallery and giving exposure to the great art that someone maybe less known is known for?
I think, I mean, the Art Institute is such a big institution, right? You can see so many things there from an art history, let's say 5,000 years ago until what's happening now. And I think it is our job, and I really sort of recognize what you were saying, it's our job to make this institution as inviting as we can. And what I would always like to say that, you know, a visit to the Art Institute is an invitation to learn something new, to see something new, to maybe recognize something mm-hmm. that you had already seen in a new way. That can also be Andy Warhol, like an artist that we think we all know because, you know, he's such a major art historical figure. But I can say that the exhibition that opens in October will shed new light on his work. And that, I think, well, when I think about how we make exhibitions or when we show the collection, it's always our job to shift it a bit, to shed new light on something so that someone who's been there like 1,000 times already can still have a new experience.
Julie, I wanted to ask as a curator, how important is the layout of the art? If you get an artist that comes in, mm-hmm. let's say somebody like Andy Warhol, you're not just showing pieces of art, you're telling a story. And so how important is it as a curator to really think about the experience of the person that's coming into the gallery?
It's everything, really. I mean, we are always curating our exhibitions for the public and being accessible and clear in our thesis around an exhibition, what we're trying to say, the story we're telling. Thesis is just a different way of saying the story behind, right, the exhibition. And so for us, it's both the layout, the physical layout of placing artworks within a gallery and creating a conversation between artworks on the wall, on the floor, right? So it's not just look at one piece, move on, forget that, and move on to the next piece. We're always creating a dialogue between artworks within a space. And hopefully through the writing and the didactic panels, the text on the wall, we are inviting viewers to, as Hendrik said, learn something new, mm-hmm. create connections. I tend to conceive of exhibitions when I curate them as propositions for our audiences to consider. It's not sort of an authoritative statement of this is exactly the meaning behind this artist's work, full stop, period. It's really more, I invite you to consider this work and bring your knowledge, your experience to this to have a conversation.
And I think institutions have like shifted over the years. I mean, I think maybe in the old days, so to speak, it was, you know, an institution's job to maybe tell you what good art is or what you should know somehow. And I find this shift quite interesting that it's now, okay, we're showing what we like, what we think is good. Otherwise, it wouldn't be there, of course. But when I do an exhibition, I do a lot of like tours and stuff, and I learn so much from these tours because you get all these types of, let's say, new perspective, whether it's, you know, high school kids or whatever it may be, to kind of like shift also my sort of perception on what this artist or artwork may be. So I think I would encourage everyone to step in, whether it's the art fair, the Art Institute, the DePaul, and look at what we've done, challenge that, and build your own like relationship to that.
Stephanie, I'll end with you on this conversation. You know, the art fairs, we talk about it, and I think about it. I mentioned the documentary, and I think it was The Price of Everything that was on HBO. Mm-hmm. It didn't necessarily, for someone, like I said, like a layman who doesn't travel much in contemporary art, it was stark in the way they said, I had no idea that that's what was happening, that Wall Street was essentially trading and buying paintings like it was like it's stocks, you know, and putting them away into a closet and hoping one day it's going to mature and sell it for more. And there's these auction houses. It's a great documentary. But how much is that happening at the art fair? Is that what a collector's coming in and that's the idea? They're looking at this one booth and this one artist and they're going after and there's a bidding war. Like, how much of that kind of stuff is similar?
Oh, well, there's a dark side to the art world. Like, there's a dark side to every part of the world. There's many levels of it. I would say that the art world is incredibly warm and generous most of the time. When we're traveling around, you know, I go to almost every art fair in the world. So that's, I think I clocked like 43 or 46 art fairs.
Wow.
You win.
This year. Right. No one should go to that many art fairs ever. But when we travel to all of these major international hubs, they're all major cities that these fairs take place in or burgeoning, you know, scenes. And every time I mention that I work for the Chicago Fair, everyone's eyes just light up and say, Chicago, oh my goodness, the institutions, they're just the best. We really want to come. I've never been to Chicago. And I don't know. I would say that my time at other fairs and my experience of the art world is not this dystopian Wall Street trading side of things. Right. You know, it's an unregulated market, that's for sure. But there are rules. And typically what we're doing is I'm going out to artist studios and being welcomed into collectors' homes and seeing collections that I've never seen before. And all of this gives us ideas of how we can bring that work to Chicago.
It's amazing too, and we got to wrap here, but it's amazing because that documentary shed light on how much iconic artwork that we may even know, and whether it be an Andy Warhol or not, out they're not in the art
institute. There's a
they're
backup
in a living room
for sure.
Yeah, it's someone's living room in a high-rise condo, and you're like, ah, that blows my mind. But that's the way the art world works. Right. So, the International Exposition of Contemporary and Modern Art Expo Chicago is through this weekend here in Chicago at Navy Pier. The Expo Chicago artistic director is Stephanie Cristello from the Art Institute of Chicago, contemporary art curator Hendrik Folkerts, and director of chief curator from the DePaul Art Museum, Julie Rodriguez-Widholm, all with me tonight. Guys, thanks so much for coming over. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Jordan. Extension 720 rolling along here till 10 o'clock. 312-981-7200. Coming up, George Freeman. More performance in our performance studio, as well as conversation coming up. The great jazz guitarist is going to be playing at the Winters Jazz Club coming up this weekend, so check it out. It'll be great. Well, the Floating Museum, folks, will be a part of this year's Expo Chicago. The Floating Museum has become one of the more talked-about museums in Chicago because they forego the brick and mortar and take the concept of a museum, bring it to the people. They're the ones responsible for the barge on the Chicago River a few years back, which is a floating museum. If you're out at Navy Pier for the Expo, you'll see their founder's work, which is a huge sculpture of four faces representing the city's founders. Jean-Baptiste DuSable, of course. We've also got his wife, Kitahawa. Harold Washington's on there. And a bust of a young boy by artist William Artis. It's been recently on display along stops on the Green Line as part of the new exhibit, Cultural Transit Assembly. But this summer, it's all about the Green Line. So if you've been riding the CTA train line through the West Side, you may have seen different installations at several of the stations. An art exhibit from the comfort of your seat. We went out to the Conservatory Station in Garfield Park to witness this for ourselves. And what we saw was a slew of artistic street signs in a park space adjacent to the train. We met up with two of the co-directors of the Floating Museum, Fahim Majid and Andrew Shockman. Here's the conversation. We're standing here in Garfield Park, just right off the Conservatory stop of the Green Line, with two of the guys who bring us the Floating Museum and also the new exhibit that is really using the Green Line as an active space. Instead of taking the community to the museum, you're bringing museum to the community, or actually engaging with the community when it comes to this space. So Fahid, start us off here. Give us an idea of what the Floating Museum is before we get into this specific exhibit.
Yeah, so the Floating Museum is a art collective and non-for-profit that thinks about the city as the museum and the neighborhoods as the galleries. And oftentimes we engage with many different organizations, museums, activating collections, and really being kind of responsive to the, I guess, flow of the spaces that we're in. So it's kind of hard to put your finger on. We do a lot of different things from design and art building and installation. And
where, Andrew, where's the idea come from? Just this, the great, noble pursuit, what you guys are doing, but when do you get the collective of artists together to do this, to actually execute?
Well, one thing is that the city has a central business district, and there are museum campuses which tend to serve that central business district. So one of the thoughts was to flip that idea around and think about the city as a horizontal feel full of culture. So a lot of the people that we participate with are from the city of Chicago, and we work with them to stage these. So it's not just that we're a kind of museum hierarchical. We work with people, not for them, as partners, to think about the city of Chicago as a cultural field.
We've seen more and more of a emphasis from the city of Chicago on public art and trying to engage different communities, and like you said, not just down in the central business district. Do you see that? I mean, as a city invests in public art, does this fall into that category?
Yeah, I think it does. I think in some sort of ways it pushes it. We think about adjacent models, not alternate models. So there's a way that kind of public art works. There's a way that museums work. And here's just another model that maybe pushes how that happens a little better. And I mean, it's really about doing with and not for. And some of the questions in museums and a lot of other cultural spaces is, how can we get the communities to invest in these spaces? And the idea is that if you actually build it with the communities, then they're always going to be invested, because they're implicated in its success and its failings.
We've seen so much in the pop-up space in commerce, you know, when it comes to consumerism, just constant, whether it be a record shop or a shoe shop or a clothing shop, the pop-up art exhibits, as we see more and more of this kind of thing taking a space, as we're kind of in the median right adjacent to the Garfield Park Conservatory, this is an area that's usually clear. So to have this pop up with all the signs that you have, and we'll get to it in just a moment, there is something to it, this idea that it's almost authentic because of the pop-up nature of it.
Also, if you think about the city, there are over 600 parks with over 438 field houses, something like that. The city has a multiple and distributed network for creating a cultural network, not just recreation and sport infrastructure.
Yeah.
So this is a kind of model testing the boundaries of what that infrastructure can do. I think the same is true with the river, which we activated a few years ago, and the same is true in thinking about rail infrastructure. We think about it as a way to get from point A to point B, but it's also a civic space. It's one of the few remaining democratic spaces in urban life. So to think about activating it for cultural conversation, dialogue, civic activation, that's the idea.
Yeah. It's great, too, because you really do think about, when you have any of the green space in the city of Chicago, you're right. It automatically goes to maybe a movie in the park so the community can come out, maybe a performance, or perhaps, in most cases, some sort of sporting event or barbecue gathering, if you will. So there is this direct connection to art and the public space.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of ways we're not like doing anything that hasn't already been done. It's just about curating those actions to maybe pull out something different or highlight something in a different sort of way. When we explain that we're going to install art in space, that's not unusual. But then when you see the process of who kind of gets to take part in kind of like curating that space, or what are the artists that get to be involved in that, or how can you leverage that to draw attention to something that's already happening in the neighborhood, then it becomes a little different. But the pieces are already there. The neighborhoods already have amazing things happening in them, but oftentimes those things aren't supported, they're not visible in a certain sort of way, but there's always someone that's shouldering the weight of that. So it's really about identifying some of those individuals and then trying to support them or make connections to other partners in a sort of way.
You mentioned the river, and that was something you guys did a couple years back, where you had the floating museum that was on the river and people could engage. And when you actually docked, I saw some of the pictures and the video, it almost turned into a gallery right on the side of the river. Is amazing, all over, not just downtown, but all over the branches of the river. Here you are, and this is the transit project you guys have been working on. It really does, in this way, is it engages community, but it's also almost like the rider on the Green Line going from all on the west side of Chicago they almost get this gallery happening outside their window as they go by. Tell us a little bit about this project.
Well, if you think about the CTA, it's not just a way to get from point A to point B, but it's also an observation machine. You look out the window, you survey the landscape, and hopefully there's an element of surprise with these projects where they pop up and you think, maybe I'll stop there, maybe I'll get off, look at an art exhibit, invest some time in that part of the city, get to know that part of the city. Avery R. Young, who's one of our collaborators, yeah, likes to say, too, if you're on the way to Lollapalooza, you might get a concert on the way to the concert. So it's a way of activating civic infrastructure in another way that takes advantage of it as a collective space, not just a sort of functional.
All right, so
thing.
We're standing in this median right off of Lake Street in Garfield Park. With all these sort of stop signs, they're almost what you would know to be utility signs, but they're painted different. They have different messages on them. Take us through what we're standing in here.
Well, in Garfield Park, which is one of the parks that we've been collaborating with for some time with various partners, including the Advisory Council and the West Side Cultural Arts Council, we kind of selected three sites within the park, about a block apart. And each of those sites is a field of signs, different colors, yellow, red, and blue. From a distance, they look like an installation as you're driving by. They're kind of massive, and you see it, and it draws you in. And then once you come in, it turns into an art gallery. So we worked with about 15 or so artists to create works specifically responding to the park and a prompt that our other co-director, Avery R. Young, wrote. So it turns into a nice little walk through the park, but then also a gallery.
The yellow signs kind of grab the attention, but when you get in here, you start to see different pieces of art on the signs that are surrounding it.
If you look over there, there's a sign with a person on it telling right. you that that's a crosswalk. So if you're driving, it's sending you a signal to watch out for people crossing the street. And if you look over there, there's a sign that says one way, and that's telling, it's an administrative message telling you that that's a one-way street and you shouldn't drive the wrong direction down it. So those signs are often telling you what you can and cannot do. And these signs, they're kind of aggregated. There's signs all around us, but these are an aggregation of the same infrastructure in a way, but turned for a different use. So it's a color field. It defines a space. It sets up a gallery in the public realm. So it's like borrowing infrastructure and collecting it and then amplifying a message in a
and
territory.
Playing right off of this this passive experience that is the Green Line. Right, you can hear the trains going by here, exactly. But that's the idea, that you're playing off of a passive.
Well, if you think of how a museum operates, right? You go to a museum, it's very hard to see all of the shows. In the same sort of way, there's different shows happening throughout the city. So there's a show that's popping up in Austin. There's a show in Garfield. There's an inflatable that's an exhibition. There's show. There's two cars that are actually have exhibitions on the cars on the Green Line. So there's these different shows that are happening, and the Green Line is kind of the connector. It's the hallway in some sort of way that moves from the west side in Austin to Inglewood on the south side, and that's why we specifically chose the Green Line, focusing on the areas that often are second thoughts when it comes to dispersing cultural capital and support.
As we wrap up here, but just, you know, the idea that you got this is going to be up through the fall and people see this. What's success for this project? Obviously, it's not necessarily an awareness project. It's not a money project by any stretch. So what is success for the Floating Museum and this particular transit project?
I think success in a lot of ways is kind of a slow build with our partners and making sure that we're aware of how installation like this actually benefits everyone involved. You know, our partners, you know, including like the park districts. Think about that. You mentioned some of the public art museums, some of the neighborhood partners, and thoughtfully doing something beautiful that people, number one, like, but also see how it benefits a bit broader push. So it's a very diverse project and a lot of different interests involved.
I'd also say, and we talk about this a lot, that everything we do is a rehearsal for another thing. So in a way, we're rehearsing together with municipal authorities, with civic institutions, with cultural institutions, with community partners, with artists, with each other. And through that, we develop new models of working together. And hopefully that is a rehearsal for future new models of working together and future rehearsals of expanding cultural possibility in the city.
This is the Cultural Transit Assembly, right? That's what we're calling it. Right. And this is the, you can see this along the Green Line on the west side of Chicago and Garfield Park. And you can also find out more about the Floating Museum at Floating, where's the best place people can get in more information?
Floatingmuseum.org. And we're also on social media with Facebook and Instagram. That's where we post most of our information.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
good to talk to the guys from Floating Museum. It's going to be up through the fall, so check that out. If you're on the Green Line, you can get yourself a little art exhibit as well. How about that? Coming up, George Freeman back in studio, performance studio, get some jazz. Talk to the 92-year-old legend who's going to be playing at Winter's Jazz Club just around the corner here at North Pier coming up this weekend. But how great. George Freeman. I think Milt would be proud. Jazz in the 9 o'clock hour coming up here on Extension 720. Thanks, Jordan. It's Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. Justin Kaufman with you for the next hour. George Freeman, the legendary jazz guitar player in a performance studio. And we're going to talk with him in just a minute about his illustrious career and talk to him about, I mean, just looking at his bio, it's crazy to think that he was in jazz ensembles and quartets in the mid to late 40s. And now, at the age of 92, he's still putting out music. This year, he put out George the Bomb, special guest Billy Branch, which and George played at the Jazz Fest just the other week and did a great job. They brought the house down. George Freeman, he is in our performance studio right now, and he is performing with Mike Alamana. This is the song, the title track off the album, George the Bomb. Here is George Freeman with George the Bomb. Thank you.
you go. George Freeman in studio, the 92-year-old legendary guitar player, jazz guitar player, playing with Mike Alemana. Mike Alemana's quartet and George Freeman will be at Winter's Jazz Club coming up on the 20th, which is tomorrow night. So check him out there. We're going to talk with George Freeman about his illustrious career and his life in jazz. A 92-year-old legend coming up next here on Extension 720. Welcome back to Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. The iconic jazz legend, legend guitar player George Freeman is my guest tonight. His album, George the Bomb, with special guest Billy Branch, is out. He's playing at Winter's Jazz Club coming up this Friday. George, great to have you here. Thanks so much for coming in and performing.
Thank you so much. It's an honor to be here with you. I want you to know that.
Thank you. And I think it's the honor is all mine. 92
both
years
both
old.
Both of us, okay?
Both of us. We're both honored, right. 92 years old. You've been playing jazz music in Chicago for so many years.
Right.
When you look back on the latest record, what's different, what's unique about this record as opposed to some of the stuff you've done in the past?
This record here is quite different. Just for one thing, it's George the Bomb. And George the Bomb is quite different because it goes back to things that I've been doing all of my life. And my wife named this tune George the Bomb because when she first saw me, she thought I was the bomb. And all these years have went by, and she said, oh, she heard George the Bomb. She said, heard me play like that. She said, oh, that's it, George the Bomb. So this is entitled George the Bomb.
You have such an eclectic style. You can do pretty much anything. And in this record, you do a lot of blues. And you've always been sort of a swing jazz guitar player. Where does that come from, the idea that you're not just straight-ahead jazz guy, that you could play it all?
I was brought up playing the blues. And in Chicago, you got to be able to play the blues. And I was playing, I heard T-Bone Walker play the blues at the Rum Boogie Cafe. I was a little kid. And he's playing the guitar behind his neck. Well, I wasn't too impressed with that. But I was impressed with him playing the guitar. And he was singing, You Call It Stormy Monday. And that just knocked me out. And then my brother, he brought a radio to the house. And the radio had WMAQ on there, WIND, and WGN. Is it still the same thing?
720, yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah.
720, right?
Yeah, right, right.
I remember that. And I was about 12 years old then.
You have played with so many great jazz legends, and they have played with you. Take us back to some of the clubs. I was thinking about it when I was looking at your bio, of a lot of the jazz clubs and places that you've played that are no longer around.
Yeah.
Just thinking, recalling back, do you think as those clubs, like back in the 50s and 60s, that you could go out and every week and play a different jazz and blues club?
Well, that's all gone. I was mostly playing ballrooms. You had a club called the Pershing Ballroom and the Parkway Ballroom. They had clubs at that time used to give dances, and I worked the clubs with my brother, Vaughn and Bruss. I played mostly ballrooms. That's where I learned to get a big sound at, because at that time, everybody was jitterbugging, and you had to play that hard music to make people dance. And you had one microphone for the whole band. Stan couldn't come there, had one mic. Count Basie come there, one mic. So I played that with Dustin Young. He had one mic. And I played with Coleman Hawkins, Illinois Jacket, Bill Webster, all the cats. And Charlie Parker.
Mm-hmm.
Charlie Parker wouldn't go on the bandstand without me. He said, where's George?
To play jazz guitar. For guitar players out there who might play rock and roll or might just do any other kind of music, they recognize how difficult jazz guitar is because it is improvisation. You need to be able to go with where the song is going. How different is that than just regular guitar playing?
It's quite different. It's quite different. First of all, you got to hear it. See, guitar comes in all kind of different. You got guitar with Western style. You got jazz. You got the blues. Guitar comes all kind of ways. But when I was coming in, I was playing strictly bebop. I was a bebop player. And in Chicago, you had to play on the west side and the north side and the south side. So playing on the south side, I managed to play jazz. Then you go to the west side, I went there with Donna Washington, and he had to play the blues. My brother used to tell me, George, I'll be playing the blues. And Vaughn said, don't forget Bird. He wanted me to play the hip jazz.
Right, right, right.
And so I've been playing hip jazz all my life. I haven't been playing blues is one thing, but I've been playing hip jazz all my life. And then when we recorded with Joni and Sparrow, and we had the harmonica player in there, Billy Branch, and Billy wanted me to play hip because he's playing the blues. I don't know. I was with Jimmy McGriff and Elasticast. They said, George, you got to play the blues. And so I've been playing the blues all along. So I didn't have no problems playing the blues.
Everyone knows Chicago's music is the blues, but it also is the jazz. And I will say, you know, because New York gets a lot of credit for everything with Blue Note and everything that happened in New York City in the 50s and 60s, but Chicago has always been a jazz town.
Chicago swings more than any place in the world. Chicago musicians have always known to be swingers. But you think about it, all the cats come out of Chicago could swing. Of course, New York City is known for notes. They play notes. And see, I was out there with John Coltrane, all them cats. I was out there with John when John first started playing. He's playing the alto saxophone. And we went through there. I went out on the road with Johnny Griffin in 1947. Went to New York. And Sonny Rollins was there. They was all playing bebop. We left there and went to Philadelphia, and I met all the cats. I met Ben Webster and Fats Navarro and John Coltrane playing alto. All the cats seemed to like me because I was playing hip on the guitar. Well, my brother played saxophone.
Mm-hmm.
So therefore, I couldn't do nothing else but play hip. And my brother was bringing home this radio with WGN on it. I never will forget it as long as I live. And he put on Benny Goodman and Charlie Christen. And when he put that on, I heard Charlie Christen play, and that was it.
Your family, the Freemans, and your brother Vaughn, you have done so much for Chicago's music community,
not just the blues and the jazz, but
you have. And you think back to not only what you have done to create music, but how you have fostered and developed younger talent. I know Vaughn used to do the New Apartment Lounge. How important was that, and is that, to jazz and blues musicians to be able to give back to the community?
It's great. It's great, but you know, when I was coming up, people recognized jazz because they could hear the music, they could hear the sound, they could hear. I'll give you a good example of like Moody's Move for Love. That's just an example. Moody's made a solo, but the cats put lyrics to the solo, and that's what they used to do back then. They could hear the lyrics, they could hear the words, they could hear the melody, and they could hear where he was going. And when I played with Bird, just a mentioned the fact that they could hear what you was playing.
Yeah.
So it's still going on right now to this very day.
Is it?
Things haven't changed. People still howling, screaming, and you playing. You know, they still want to hear.
You just played the Jazz Festival, and for all accounts, it was a great show, and people loved that you were back there. What does it mean to play in front of a Chicago audience?
I love it. I just love it. First of all, like I said before, you got to get their attention first. When I come out there, everybody say yeah. That's to get their attention, because if you don't get their attention, they're someplace else.
Yeah.
So everybody say yeah. I say hell yeah. And they say hell yeah. And then I say, let's get started. And I told the drummer, he got to hit up hard. Hit that first tune, bam! And once you get out there and get to going, you're gone. But you got to get their attention, first of all. You can't just come out there on the stage and look at the people. Because I found out people can look at you and don't like you.
That's a good point. George, you know, 92 years young, is there a point in your life where you say, okay, I'm going to retire. I'm not going to play music anymore. I'm not going to put out albums. I'm not going to get up on stage. I'm 92. I'm gonna enjoy what I have left.
Well, I tell you the truth, no. No, indeed. Somebody told me the other day that the reason why you're getting popularity is because of your age. I don't think about age. When I think about just playing music. Now, I admit 92 years old is kind of up there.
Well, you, as evidenced tonight in this interview, but also in the performances we've heard on the show, you haven't missed a beat, and we hope for more years of George Freeman. The album is called George the Bomb, George Freeman, special guest Billy Branch, playing on Friday at the Winters Jazz Club, which is right here in North Pier. If you haven't been down there, go check it out. It's in the old Dick's Last Resort space. They're playing on Friday night, and George, I can't thank you enough for coming in, talking to us, and playing tonight here on Extension 7.
Just to thank you so much, and please come, because I need the money.
How great to have George Freeman in studio talking about his illustrious career, and then saying, you got to come to the show, I need the money. Great way to end that. George Freeman, what a classic Chicago icon, a guy who has played all over the city decade after decade after decade. To think that he's playing in the mid to late 40s and, you know, he's still playing in 2019 tomorrow night at Winters Jazz Club, that's unbelievable to me. Mike Alemana's quartet and George Freeman will be at Winters Jazz Club, which is right here at North Pier, right here behind us, essentially, over here, next to Navy Pier. Tomorrow night, so come on out. Amazing. And thanks to Joni Pilato, of course, who also gave vocals on the track that we heard earlier in the show. You know what? We've got one more, so why don't we play some George Freeman right after the news? Play a little some more jazz here on Extension 720 to keep us company tonight. How about that? Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. Justin Kaufman with you till 10 o'clock. George Freeman in our performance studio tonight with Mike Alemana, and Mike Alemana's quartet will be on display tomorrow night at Winters Jazz Club. And George and Mike have been playing guitar in studio with us. Joni Pilato joined as well for vocals a little bit earlier in the program. But we want to finish it off and let them play one more. Here's George and Mike in our performance studio with song Mike's Tempo. Take it away, guys. Thank you. you go. George Freeman, Mike Alemana, and two great guitar players. George Freeman, the legend, 92 years old, still playing great guitar, jazz guitar, and he's going to be playing at Winter's Jazz Club coming up tomorrow night with Mike Alemana and the quartet. George Freeman, just a pleasure tonight to have jazz music from the great. We'll continue. Extension 720. Stay with us. Couple of programming notes. We will be back on Monday. We're going to be in. Andrea and the reporters will not be on, so we'll be on from 7 to 10 on Monday, and we'll also be on Thursday, the 26th. So we've got a couple of shows coming up, and then at the, I guess it would be the end of next weekend, it's the end of the baseball season. Chicago White Sox, of course, broadcast here on 720 WGN, and their season will conclude. And the Blackhawks start right around that time, the end of the I think their first game is the game in Prague on the 4th. But that means that there will be more Extension 720 coming your way. Blackhawks have a lot of weekend type games in the first month or two. So we have a couple of weeks where it's a string of shows put together. And that's exciting. It's exciting to get back into the flow, the routine of being on at night, not just one-off type stuff. It's exciting. I was just reading that the... this is a great stat. I just saw this on Twitter earlier today. You know, as people start to feel a little, and like myself, very anxious about the Chicago Bears, right? Very anxious about whether or not we're good, whether or not we're bad, whether Mitch Trubisky's terrible, whatever it might be. Did not know this, but for the this was the first time that the Denver Broncos have gone 0-2 in 12 years, something like that. And it also points to the that they have played a combination. They don't lose at home. They have like an extraordinary record when it comes to playing at Mile High or whatever they call it now in September. That's why they have such a strong record. That's why you don't see them go 0-2. It doesn't matter if they could have crappy teams. It could be Trevor Siemian from the old Northwestern quarterback throwing the rock around for the Broncos, and they'd still be 1-1. But there's something about playing in Denver in September that is, you just don't want to get that on your schedule.
Yeah, heat and altitude.
Yeah, and so for the Chicago Bears to go in and get a victory there, it almost goes against the grain. Most teams, even good teams, go in there and they have a hard time. So as much as we struggled in that game, there is something to be said about Matt Nagy, Mitch Trubisky, and company finding a way to win that game on the road where the percentages are not with you and be able to come home with a victory. Should have won the game against the Packers at Soldier Field. That's a different story. But the point being, 1-1 with a victory, instead of sort of doom and gloom, because it was doom and gloom, to think about stealing a victory where victories aren't stolen often is probably more positive, optimistic way to think about it.
All right, I'm feeling good.
Yeah?
Yeah.
What do you think about the going to Washington on Monday?
You're going to destroy Washington.
Yeah, we'll be on here opposite that game.
I'm glad you guys are being positive, though, about the Bears.
Right?
Because there's a lot of negativity, and I would say that I'm in the negative camp.
Oh, no. I'm with you. I'm up to this point.
The Mitch?
Yeah, it has to be Mitch.
And he's just, like, their defense is great, obviously. But if he's not good, it really won't matter if their defense is great.
Yeah. We've seen this storyline
forever.
It's so tired in Chicago. The idea that a quarterback, Rex Grossman,
Made it to the Super Bowl.
He did. Exactly. And you feel like Mitch Trubisky, you hear a lot of arguments of 12-4 last year. My point being that we've had this storyline of a really great defense and a offense that just needs to get us there for far too long. And we were sold that Matt Nagy was not going to be that. Matt Nagy is an offensive genius, quarterback whisperer. He's going to come in, and he showed a lot of razzle-dazzle last year, and it kind of grabbed our attention. We were just blown away by all the trickery and the fact we were actually an offensive team for a second.
Yeah, there's a lot of talk about, like, oh, you know, Bears' defense is so great. You know, they don't need to have a great quarterback, but why? Why can't we have a great quarterback for once?
The only thing I can think about, and, you know, when I think, try to be optimistic and try to be positive, that it's all about timing.
It's all about, I guess, at the end of the day, the fact that maybe they didn't have a preseason, and so now it takes a little bit of time for Mitch Trubisky to figure out game speed in the NFL, and not unlike last year when we had that great game, and people forget about this, but they had that great game in Tampa Bay, or it was in here, I think it was in Chicago, but there was this thought that, oh, the Fitzmagic was coming to town, and that they had scored like 50 points like 2 weeks in a row. Remember that? The high-flying Tampa Bay Buccaneers offense. And, oh, they got a good defense. There's no way Mitch Trubisky and company are going to win this game. And he threw, what was it, 6-7 touchdowns in that game?
Tampa's corners were so bad in that game, you could have thrown for 700 yards.
If I'm not mistaken, Chris Conte's in the secondary of the Tampa. He was in that game.
I think you're right. Yeah.
Yeah. So it gives you an idea for Bears fans. But yeah, but there was the same storyline was leading up to that game, that people were really not sold on Mitch Trubisky, and he kind of squashed that. Now I could go positive or negative there. You can go positive saying, oh, it's, you know, this is how the season's going to ebb and flow. Or you go negative saying, you know, why are we going backwards? We shouldn't be in the same position where week three in the second year of this Matt Nagy experience, we're doing the same thing, saying, well, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, it's unfortunate that he was such a high draft pick. It's unfortunate to see Patrick Mahomes and Deshaun Watson, you know, lighting up the league. But if take those two other guys out of the question,
yep,
would we still be scrutinizing Mitch as much?
He's pretty bad. And it's not even, I remember we were all kind of Jay Cutler apologists, so we had that kind of 50-50 where for a while there, Bears fans were like, no, he's good, it's the offensive line, or, you know, no, I hate Cutler. I think everybody in the city can unify around the fact that Mitch Trubisky's terrible right now.
Nice, though, at least.
Yeah.
It seems like Mitch is nice. Like, don't you feel like you just want to, like, sit and have a beer with Mitch? Whereas Cutler are just...
Yeah, right. You're so right, Jordan. Well, that might be his saving grace. When he turns it around and he turns a corner, or we give him the space to turn the corner, everyone will be on his side. It won't be...
Yeah.
You know, when Cutler would actually have a good game, he'd still have that cocky attitude with the press, with the fans, and everything like that. I still think the reason that the Bears lost on the opener against Packers, Cutler was in the building. I think that's just bad mojo. He shouldn't have been anywhere, and he was there for the 100th anniversary, and it's like, no. The minute I saw him, I'm like, no, this is going to turn this bad. This is bad. No, get out of here. No, you can't be here.
Is Cutler at Wrigley right now?
Yeah. Well, I don't even know what's happening there.
They're losing.
Is it over?
They're two strikes from losing.
Hmm.
5-4 in the 10th. Kimbrell gave up a home run.
Yeah, I saw that. You know, I got to say about the Cubs, you know, the only thing I will say, it's this terrible. This is not how you want to see a season end, where you're losing games you should be winning. Flaherty's amazing second half pitcher for the Cardinals. But I will say this. The idea that here we are in late September, and the star power that's on display in this game, whether it's Anthony Rizzo pulling a Nat or Roy Hobbs and showing up and playing in the game, whether it's even Andrew Miller coming in, Craig Kimbrell, Matt Carpenter with the home run, there's a lot of star power. There's a lot of MLB playoff experience in this series. It's kind of fun to watch.
Yeah, Cardinals just won 5-4. Castellanos just flew out to the center field wall.
Yeah. It's a bummer. Yeah.
Cutler was there. That's what I'm going with.